This is Audible.
Recorded Books Incorporated presents an unabridged recording of Apollyon by Tim LaHaye and Jerry B. Jenkins, narrated by Richard Ferrone. This work is copyrighted 1999 by Tim LaHaye and Jerry B. Jenkins. This recording is copyrighted 2000 by Recorded Books Incorporated. As this, the fifth title in the Left Behind series, begins, the world holds its breath as the Tribulation Force ventures to Jerusalem for the great meeting of the witnesses. As the Tribulation calendar moves ever closer to the halfway point, the Fourth Judgment is about to come down upon the earth. And now, Apollyon.
Prologue, from the conclusion of Soul Harvest. Rayford believed the only way to exonerate Amanda was to decode her files, but he also knew the risk. He would have to face whatever they revealed. Did he want the truth, regardless? The more he prayed about that, the more convinced he became that he must not fear the truth. What he learned would affect how he functioned for the rest of the tribulation. If the woman who had shared his life had fooled him, whom could he trust? If he was that bad a judge of character, what good was he to the cause? Maddening doubts filled him, but he became obsessed with knowing. Either way, lover or liar, wife or witch, he had to know. The morning before the start of the most talked-about mass meeting in the world, Rayford approached Carpathia in his office. "Your Excellency," he began, swallowing any vestige of pride. "I'm assuming you'll need Mac and me to get you to Israel tomorrow."
"Talk to me about this, Captain Steele." "They are meeting against my wishes, so I had planned not to sanction it with my presence."
"But your promise of protection. Ah, that resonated with you, did it not? You know well where I stand. And you also know that I tell you where to fly, not vice versa. Do you not think that if I wanted to be in Israel tomorrow, I would have told you before this? So those who wonder if you are afraid of the scholar who... afraid... showed you up on the internet and called your bluff before an international audience. You are trying to bait me, Captain Steele," Carpathia said, smiling. "Frankly, I believe you know you will be upstaged in Israel by the two witnesses and by Dr. Ben-Judah."
"The two witnesses?"
"If they do not stop their black magic, the drought and the blood, they will answer to me. They say you can't harm them until the due time. I will decide the due time. And yet Israel was protected from the earthquake and the meteors. You believe the witnesses are responsible for that? I believe God is. Tell me, Captain Steele, do you still believe that a man who has been known to raise the dead could actually be the Antichrist?" Rayford hesitated, wishing Zion was in the room. "The enemy has been known to imitate miracles," he said. "Imagine the audience in Israel if you were to do something like that. Here are people of faith coming together for inspiration. If you are God, if you could be the Messiah, wouldn't they be thrilled to meet you?" Carpathia stared at Rayford, seeming to study his eyes. Rayford believed God. He had faith that regardless of his power, regardless of his intentions, Nikolai would be impotent in the face of the 144,000 witnesses who carried the seal of Almighty God on their foreheads. "If you are suggesting," Carpathia said carefully, "that it only makes sense that the global community potentate bestow upon those guests a regal welcome second to none, you may have a point."
Rayford had said nothing of the sort, but Carpathia heard what he wanted to hear.
Thank you, Rayford said.
Captain Steele, schedule that flight.
Chapter 1. Rayford Steele worried about Mac McCullum's silence in the cockpit of Global Community 1 during the short flight from New Babylon to Tel Aviv.
Do we need to talk later? Rayford said quietly.
Mac put a finger to his lips and nodded.
Rayford finished communicating with New Babylon ground and air traffic control, then reached beneath his seat for the hidden reverse intercom button. It would allow him to listen in on conversations in the Condor 216's cabin between Global Community Potentate Nikolai Carpathia, Supreme Commander Leon Fortunato, and Pontifex Maximus Peter Matthews, head of Enigma Babylon 1 World Faith. But just before Rayford depressed the button, he felt Mac's hand on his arm. Mac shook his head. Rayford shuddered.
They know? He mouthed.
Mac whispered,
"Don't risk it until we talk."
Rayford received the treatment he had come to expect on initial descent into Tel Aviv. The tower at David Ben-Gurion cleared other planes from the area, even those that had begun landing sequences. Rayford heard anger in the voices of other pilots as they were directed into holding patterns miles from the Condor. Per protocol, no other aircraft were to be in proximity to the Condor, despite the extraordinary air traffic expected in Israel for the meeting of the witnesses.
"Take the landing, Mac," Rayford said.
Mac gave a puzzled glance, but complied. Rayford was impressed at how the Holy Land had been spared damage from the Wrath of the Lamb earthquake. Other calamities had befallen the land and the people, but to Rayford, Israel was the one place that looked normal from the air since the earthquake and the subsequent judgments. Ben-Gurion Airport was alive with traffic. The big planes had to land there while smaller craft could put down near Jerusalem. Worried about Mac's misgivings, still Rayford couldn't suppress a smile. Carpathia had been forced not only to allow this meeting of believers, but also to pledge his personal protection of them. Of course, he was the opposite of a man of his word, but having gone public with his assurances, he was stuck. He would have to protect even Rabbi Zion ben Judah, spiritual head of the tribulation force. Not long before, Dr. Ben-Judah had been forced to flee his homeland under cover of night, a universal bounty on his head. Now he was back as Carpathia's avowed enemy, leader of the 144,000 witnesses and their converts. Carpathia had used the results of the most recent trumpet judgments to twice postpone the Israel conference, but there was no stopping it again. Just before touchdown, when everyone aboard should have been tightly strapped in, Rayford was surprised by a knock at the cockpit door.
"Leon," he said, turning. "We're about to land."
"Protocol, Captain," Fortunato barked.
"What do you want?"
"Besides that you refer to me as Supreme Commander, His Excellency asks that you remain in the cockpit after landing for orders."
"We're not going to Jerusalem," Rayford said.
Mac stared straight ahead.
"Precisely," Fortunato said. "Much as we all know you want to be there."
Rayford had been certain Carpathia's people would try to follow him to the rest of the tribulation force. Fortunato left and shut the door, and Rayford said,
"I'll take it, Mac."
Mac shifted control of the craft, and Rayford immediately exaggerated the angle of descent while depressing the reverse intercom button. He heard Carpathia and Matthews asking after Fortunato, who had clearly taken a tumble. Once the plane was parked, Fortunato burst into the cockpit.
"What was that, Officer McCullum?"
"My apologies, Commander," Mac said. "It was out of my hands. All due respect, sir, but you shouldn't have been out of your seat during landing."
"Listen up, gentlemen," Fortunato said, kneeling between them. "His Excellency asks that you remain in Tel Aviv, as we are not certain when he might need to return to New Babylon. We have rented you rooms near the airport. GC personnel will transport you. Buck Williams sat in the bowels of Teddy Kollek Stadium in Jerusalem with his pregnant wife, Chloe. He knew she was in no way healed enough from injuries she had suffered in the great earthquake to have justified the flight from the United States, but she would not be dissuaded. Now she appeared weary. Her bruises and scars were fading, but Chloe still had a severe limp, and her beauty had been turned into a strange cuteness by the unique reshaping of her cheekbone and eye socket.
"You need to help the others, Buck," she said. "Now go on, I'll be fine."
"I wish you'd go back to the compound," he said.
"I'm fine," she insisted. "I just need to sit a while. I'm worried about Hattie. I said I wouldn't leave her unless she improved or became a believer, and she's done neither."
Pregnant, Hattie Durham had been left home fighting for her life against poison in her system. Dr. Floyd Charles attended her while the rest of the Tribulation Force, including new member Ken Ritz, another pilot, had made the pilgrimage to Israel. "Floyd will take good care of her."
"I know. Now leave me alone a while."
Rayford and Mac were instructed to wait on the plane as Carpathia, Fortunato, and Matthews were received with enthusiasm on the tarmac. Fortunato stood dutifully in the background as Matthews declined to make a public statement but introduced Carpathia.
"I cannot tell you what a pleasure it is to be back in Israel," Carpathia said with a broad smile. "I am eager to welcome the devotees of Dr. Ben-Judah and to display the openness of the global community to diverse opinion and belief. I am pleased to reaffirm my guarantee of safety to the rabbi and the thousands of visitors from all over the world. I will withhold further comment, assuming I will be welcome to address the honored assemblage within the next few days."
The dignitaries were ushered to a helicopter for the hop to Jerusalem, while their respective entourages boarded an opulent motor coach. When Rayford and Mac finished post-flight checks and finally disembarked, a global community jeep delivered them to their hotel. Mac signaled Rayford not to say anything in the car or either of their rooms. In the coffee shop, Rayford finally demanded to know what was going on. Buck wished Chloe had been able to sleep on the flight from the States. Ken Ritz had procured a Gulfstream jet, so it was the most comfortable international flight Buck had ever enjoyed. But the four of them, Ken, Buck, Chloe, and Zion, had been too excited to rest. Zion spent half the time on his laptop, which Ken transmitted to a satellite, keeping the rabbi in touch with his worldwide flock of millions. A vast network of house churches had sprung up, seemingly spontaneously, with converted Jews, clearly part of the 144,000 witnesses, taking leadership positions. They taught their charges daily based on the cyberspace sermons and lessons from the prolific Ben-Judah. Tens of thousands of such clandestine local house churches, their very existence flying in the face of the all-inclusive enigma Babylon One World Faith, saw courageous converts added to the church every day. Zion had been urging the local congregations to send their leaders to the great meeting of the witnesses, despite warnings from the global community. Nikolai Carpathia had again tried to cancel the gathering at the last minute, citing thousands of deaths from contaminated water in over a third of the world. Thrilling the faithful by calling Carpathia's bluff, Zion responded publicly on the internet. "Mr. Carpathia," he had written, "we will be in Jerusalem as scheduled, with or without your approval, permission, or promised protection. The glory of the Lord will be our rear guard." Buck would need the protection almost as much as Zion. By choosing to show up and appear in public with Ben-Judah, Buck was sacrificing his position as Carpathia's publishing chief and his exorbitant salary. Showing his face in proximity to the rabbis would confirm Carpathia's contention that Buck had become an active enemy of the global community. Rabbi Ben Judah himself had come up with the strategy of simply trusting God. "Stand right beside me when we get off the plane," he said. "No disguises, no misdirection, no hiding. If God can protect me, he can protect you. Let us stop playing Carpathia's games." Buck had long been anonymously broadcasting his own cyberspace magazine, The Truth, which would now be his sole writing outlet. Ironically, it attracted 10 times the largest reading audience he had ever enjoyed. He worried for his safety, of course, but more for Chloe's. Zion seemed supernaturally protected, but after this conference, the entire tribulation force, not to mention the 144,000 witnesses and their millions of converts, would become open archenemies of the Antichrist. Their lives would consist of half ministry, half survival. For all they had been through, it was as if the 7-year tribulation had just begun. They still had nearly 5 years until the glorious appearing of Christ to set up his 1,000-year reign on earth. What Zion's internet missives and Buck's underground electronic magazine had wrought in Israel was stunning. The whole of Israel crawled with tens of thousands of converted Jewish witnesses from the 12 tribes all over the world. Rather than asking Ken Ritz to find an out-of-the-way airstrip where the tribulation force could slip into the country unnoticed, Zion informed his audience, and also, of course, Carpathia and company, of their itinerary. Ken had landed at the tiny Jerusalem airport north of the city, and well-wishers immediately besieged the plane. A small cadre of global community armed guards, apparently Carpathia's idea of protection for Zion, would have had to open fire to get near him. The international witnesses cheered and sang and reached out to touch Zion as the tribulation force made its way to a van. The Israeli driver carefully picked his way through the crowd and south down the main drag toward the Holy City and the King David Hotel. There they had discovered that Supreme Commander Leon Fortunato had summarily bounced their reservations and several others by supremely commandeering the top floor for Nikolai Carpathia and his people. "I assume you have made provisions for our alternative," Zion told the desk clerk after 30 minutes in line. "I apologize," the young man said, slipping Zion an envelope. The rabbi glanced at Buck and pulled him away from the crowd where they opened the note. Buck looked back at Ken, who nodded to assure him he had the fragile Chloe in tow. The note was in Hebrew. "It is from Chaim," Zion said. "He writes, 'Forgive my trusted friend Nikolai for this shameful insensitivity. I have room for you and your colleagues and insist you stay with me. Page Yaakov, and you will be taken care of.'" Yaakov was Chaim Rosenzweig's driver and valet. He loaded their stuff into a Mercedes van and soon had the tribulation force installed in guest rooms at Chaim's walled and gated estate within walking distance of the old city. Buck tried to get Chloe to stay and rest while he and Ken and Zion went to the stadium. "I didn't come here to be on the sidelines," she said. "I know you're concerned about me, but let me decide what I'm up to." At Kolek Stadium, Buck had been as stunned as the others at what had been arranged. Zion was right. It had to have been God who used the rabbi's cyber pleas to pull together Israeli witnesses to handle the logistics of this most unlikely conference. In spite of and in the midst of global chaos, ad hoc committees had arranged transportation, lodging, food, sound, interpretation, and programming. Buck could tell that Zion was nearly overcome with the streamlined efficiency and no-frills program. "All you need to worry about, Dr. Ben Judah," he had been told, "is being prepared to inspire and inform us when you are due at the microphone." Zion smiled sadly. "That, and praying that we all remain under the care of our Heavenly Father." "They're on to you, Rayford," Max said over pita bread and sauce. Rayford shook his head. I haven't been a mystery to Carpathia for months. What are you talking about? You've been assigned to me. I'm listening. I don't rate direct contact with the big man anymore, but last night I was called to a meeting with Leon. The good news is they're not on to me. That is good. But they know about the device on the plane? He didn't say, but they couldn't have been clearer that your history. If the device still works, it does. Then I'll use it and keep you posted. Where will I be? Anywhere but here, Ray. I'm convinced the driver was listening. The car may have been bugged. The cockpit. No question about our rooms. They hope I'll lead them to the others, but they'll be in plain sight in Jerusalem. They want to keep you from the others, Ray. Why do you think we've been assigned to Tel Aviv? And if I leave? I'm to let them know immediately. It'll be the end of you, Ray. But I've got to see my family, the rest of the force. Not here. Carpathia's pledge is to protect Zion and the others, not you. They really think I won't go to Jerusalem? They hope you will. You must not. Rayford sat back and pursed his lips. He would not miss the job, close as it had brought him to what was going on in the camp of the enemy. He had long wondered how the end would come to this bizarre season of his life. You're taking over? Mac nodded. So they tell me. There's more good news. They like and trust David. Hasid? Good. He's been put in charge of purchasing. Beyond all the computer stuff he's been doing, he contracts for all major purchases, even in avionics. Rayford squinted. Mac pulled a yellow sheet from his jacket and slid it across the table. Don't tell me he's bought me a plane, Rayford said. Mac snorted. Should have thought of that. You know those little handheld electronic organizers? David ordered a half dozen specially built. He doesn't even know yet that he won't be seeing you around anymore. I can't steal these, not even from Carpathia. You don't have to steal them, Ray. These are just the specs and where to get them. They're not cheap, but wait till you see what these babies can do. No more laptops for you guys. Well, maybe the rabbi still needs a keyboard, but these things are solar-powered, satellite-connected, and contain geographic positioning chips. You can access the internet, send and receive, use them as phones, you name it. Rayford shook his head. I suppose he thought of tracer blocks. Of course. Rayford stuffed the sheet into a pocket. What am I gonna do, Mac? You're gonna get your tail out of this hemisphere. What else? But I have to know about Amanda. Buck will tell me only face to face, and he's in Jerusalem. Mac looked down. You know how that's gonna go, Ray. I'd be the last one to try to tell a man about his own wife, but you know as well as I do that everything points to what you don't want to hear. I haven't accepted it yet, but I have to know. Buck found out for sure? Sounds like it. How can he be sure? I told you about Hattie. Uh-huh. She knows. So ask her yourself, Ray. Go home. Like I wouldn't be noticed trying to slip out of here tomorrow morning. The GC can't keep track of everything. Use your people's pilot, Ritz, is it? What's he got to do the next few days? Rayford looked at Mac with admiration. You're not as dumb as you look, old-timer. Mac pulled a phone from his pocket. Know his number? Your phone scrambled? If I get detected talking to Ken Ritz on either of our phones... You are dumber than you look, if you think I'd risk that. I know the purchasing guy, remember? Mac showed Rayford the phone, a generic model that had been doctored by David Hasid. Rayford dialed Chloe's phone. Daddy, she exulted. Are you here? Buck considered it a privilege to pray with the Israeli committee before he and Ken and Zion headed back to find Chloe. He threw his arm around Zion. Are you as tired as I am? Exhausted. I only hope the Lord will allow me to sleep tonight. I am ready to share his message with these dear members of the family, and all that is left before that is to talk with Eli and Moisha. You will go with me, will you not? I wouldn't miss it.
Me either, Ken said.
But the news from Chloe changed Ken's plans.
Daddy called, she whispered. He needs a ride home tomorrow.
After she explained Rayford's situation, Ken decided to get the Gulfstream out of the Jerusalem airport and into Ben-Gurion that night. Buck was nearly despondent, wanting to talk to Rayford personally.
At least he can hear the truth about Amanda from the horse's mouth, he said.
An hour later, Yakov drove as they delivered Ken to the airport.
We will see you back here Friday, Zion said, embracing him.
Chloe fell asleep on Buck's shoulder during the after-dark ride to the Temple Mount. As they left the car, the spectacular new temple gleamed on the horizon.
I do not even want to see the new structure, Zion said. It is an abomination.
I can't wait to meet the witnesses, Chloe said.
You may not actually meet them, Zion cautioned. These are heavenly beings with their own agenda. They may communicate with us, they may not. We approach them with great caution.
Buck felt the usual tingle to the soles of his feet.
You know the stories, hon.
Chloe nodded.
I'm not saying I'm not scared.
The three slowed as they approached the typical crowd that gathered 30 feet from the wrought iron fence behind which the witnesses stood, sat, or spoke. Usually they spoke. No one had seen them sleep, and none dared get closer. Threats on the lives of the two witnesses had ended in the ugly deaths of would-be assassins. Buck's excitement masked his fatigue. He worried about Chloe, but wouldn't deny her this privilege. At the edge of the crowd of about 40, Buck was able to see past the fence to where Eli sat, Indian style, his back to the stone wall of a small building beyond the fence. His long hair and beard wafted softly in the breeze, but he was unmoving, unblinking, his leathery skin and burlap-like garb appearing to meld. Moisha stood 2 feet from the fence, silent, unmoving, staring at the crowd. Occasionally someone shouted, "Speak! Say something!" But that made others back away, obviously fearing the violent reactions they had heard of. Moisha's feet were spread, his arms loose at his sides. Earlier in the day, Buck had monitored on his computer a long monologue from Moisha. Sometimes the two traded off speaking, but this day must have been all Moisha's responsibility.
"Watch them carefully," Buck whispered to Chloe. "Sometimes they communicate without opening their mouths. I love how everyone understands them in his own language."
Commotion near the front caused several people to back away, opening a gap in the crowd. Someone said,
"Carpathia! It's the potentate!"
Zion held up a hand.
"Let us stay right here," he whispered.
Buck was riveted as Leon Fortunato smoothly supervised GC guards who kept gawkers from Carpathia. The potentate appeared bemused, boldly moving to within 10 feet of the fence.
"Hail, potentate!" someone shouted.
Carpathia half turned, holding a finger to his lips, and Fortunato nodded to a guard who stepped toward the crowd. They backed away farther.
"Stay here," Buck said, slipping away.
"Honey, wait,"
Chloe called, but Buck moved around behind the crowd and into the shadows. He knew he would appear to the guards as simply someone leaving, but when he was far enough away to be ignored, he doubled back through the shrubbery to where he could see Carpathia's face as he stared at Moisha. Carpathia appeared startled when Moisha suddenly spoke in a loud voice.
"Woe unto the enemy of the Most High God!"
Nikolai seemed to quickly collect himself. He smiled and spoke softly.
"I am hardly the enemy of God," he said. "Many say I am the Most High God."
Moisha moved for the first time, crossing his arms over his chest.
Carpathia, his chin in his hand, cocked his head and studied Moisha. The ancient witness spoke softly, and Buck knew only he and Carpathia could hear him. "A sword shall pierce your head," Moisha said in a haunting monotone, "and you shall surely die." Buck shivered, but it was clear that Carpathia was unmoved. "Let me tell you and your companion something," he said through clenched teeth. "You have persecuted Israel long enough with the drought and the water turned to blood. You will lift your hocus-pocus or live to regret it." Eli rose and traded places with Moisha, beckoning Carpathia closer. The potentate hesitated and looked back to his guards, who tentatively raised their weapons. Eli spoke with such volume that the crowd dispersed and ran, and even Zion and Chloe recoiled. "Until the due time, you have no authority over the lampstands of God Almighty." The guards lowered their weapons, and Fortunato seemed to hide behind them. Carpathia's smirk remained, but Buck was convinced he was seething. "We shall see," he said, "who will win in the end." Eli seemed to look through Carpathia. "Who will win in the end was determined before the beginning of time. Lo, the poison you inflict on the earth shall rot you from within for eternity." Carpathia stepped back, still grinning. "I warn you to stay away from the charade of the so-called saints. I have guaranteed their safety, not yours." Eli and Moisha spoke in unison. "He and she who have ears, let them hear. We are bound neither by time nor space, and those who shall benefit by our presence and testimony stand within the sound of our proclamation." Buck thrilled at the message and looked beyond the square to where Zion stood with Chloe. The rabbi thrust his fists in the air as if he had gotten a message, and he walked Chloe back toward the car. Buck ducked out of the shrubs and headed around the other way, arriving in the parking lot seconds later. "Did you hear that?" Zion said. Buck nodded. "Incredible!" "I didn't get it," Chloe said. "What were they saying?" "Did it sound like Hebrew to you?" Zion said. "They spoke in Hebrew." "I heard it in English," she said. "Me too," Buck said. "They said that he or she who had ears to hear." "I heard," Chloe said. "I just don't understand."
"That is the first time I ever heard them add or she," Zion said. "That was for you, Chloe. They knew we were here. We didn't have to approach them, did not have to identify ourselves, did not have to face Carpathia before we were ready. We did not even have to discuss with Eli and Moisha plans for their appearance at the stadium. They said that those who would benefit by their presence and testimony stood within the sound of their proclamation."
"They're coming?" Chloe said.
"That is what I gather," Zion said.
"When?"
"At just the right time."
Chapter 2. Rayford had a lot in common with Ken Ritz and found him fascinating. Distraught over his own future and income, and fearful of what he might learn about his late wife, Rayford nonetheless enjoyed Ken's company. More than 10 years his senior, Ken was former military, gruff, to the point, and aglow in what Zion Ben Judah called his first love of Christ. Rayford and Ken spent hours in the air on the way home bringing each other up to date on their pasts, and Rayford silently thanked God for a new friend. His relationship with Zion was as student to mentor. To Buck, he was the father-in-law.
how he missed Bruce Barnes, his first friend and spiritual guide after the rapture. Ken seemed like a gift from God. Ritz assured Rayford he could learn the Gulfstream in no time.
"You guys who drive the heavies can handle these skiffs like a bike racer going back to a trike."
"I wish it were that easy," Rayford said, "but I'll count on you for driver's training."
"Roger. And man, with your replacement there for Carpathia, what's his name again?"
Mac McCollum.
"Yeah, he gives us 3 pilots in the Trib Force. Now we gotta talk Sawbones into getting out of that GC hospital before they catch on to him. That'll give us a doctor. So 3 pilots, a doc, and a rabbi. Sounds like the start of a joke. The only member without a specialty is your daughter, and she's what I call the voice of reason. Nobody's more reasonable than Zion, of course, but Chloe's the voice of reason for guys like me who don't understand everything the scholar says."
Rayford told Ritz about David Hasid.
"I have no idea how long he'll be safe, but he gives us another pair of eyes and ears inside. Someday both he and Mac will have to run. Then look at the lineup we'll have."
"Hot dog," Ritz said, clapping.
"I don't like being on the defensive, man. Let's take on that rascal."
Rayford had never heard Nikolai referred to as a rascal, but he liked Ritz's attitude. Weary and wary after so long in Carpathia's orbit, he too longed to quit playing and get to war. Ritz seemed to grow uncomfortable when Rayford told him about Amanda.
"I'm sorry for your loss,"
he said when Rayford's story came full circle to the plane crash into the Tigris that had killed her.
"So you've heard the rest, too?"
Rayford asked, having left out the charges of her duplicity.
"Yes, sir. I didn't come to any conclusions, but I can imagine how it all makes you feel."
"But you didn't hear from Buck what he found out from Hattie?"
"I didn't even know she was talking. Tell you the truth, I'll be surprised if she's still kicking when we get back."
That wasn't what I wanted to hear. Buck hoped staying up late would make sleep come easily in the new time zone, but his brain was on Chicago time and he lay staring at the ceiling. Chloe slept soundly beside him, and for that he was grateful. By dawn in Israel, when he felt Chloe stir, Buck was so exhausted he could neither move nor open his eyes. He felt the brush of her lips on his cheek, but couldn't even emit a groan.
"Stay still, big guy," she whispered. "Huge day ahead."
She got up, and Buck soon smelled breakfast, but he fell asleep and didn't rouse until early afternoon. Rayford was impressed with Ken Ritz's facility on the radio and on the ground at Pulwalki Airport at dawn in the Chicago suburbs.
"You push this thing around like you own it," he said. "It'd be a good staff plan for the Trib Force, don't you think?"
Buck's Range Rover sat gleaming behind a damaged hangar. As they approached, a young man angled toward them.
"Rover cleans up pretty good, doesn't she?"
he said, a shock of red hair in his face.
"Yeah," Ritz said. "You been playing under the hood, too?" "Lucky for you, timing was all screwed up."
"I told you that, Ernie."
"You also told me you wouldn't be back for another week."
"I only got into that engine 'cause I was bored." Ritz introduced Ernie to Rayford, who remained guarded until Ritz pulled the young man close and said,
"Notice anything?"
Ernie stepped toward Rayford and peered at his forehead. Ernie smiled and held his hair away from his face with both hands. Rayford embraced him.
"Brother." "There's more of us around here, including the boss man,"
Ritz said. "But not too many, so we're careful. Ernie here's a Ben Judah groupie."
"You got that right," Ernie said. "I can't wait for the big meeting. It's gonna be on the net at noon tomorrow."
"We'll be watching," Rayford said, eager to get going. Half an hour later, he and Ken pulled behind the safe house in Mount Prospect in the amazingly smooth-running Rover.
"We've got to stay close to Ernie," he said.
This vehicle needs to be as travel-worthy as whatever plane we wind up with.
Did you see the front curtain move when we came by, Ray? Until he saw it was us, Floyd was probably wondering how he was going to get Hattie underground.
You get a lot of snoops?
Hardly any. The block is deserted. The roads, as you saw, are nearly impassable. So far, this has been a perfect spot. You want to see Donnie's wife's grave?
Rayford had heard how Buck and Zion had found the place. He nodded as Dr. Floyd Charles came out, the obvious question on his face.
We tried to call you, Rich said.
I've been on the phone to my guy at the hospital.
This here's Rayford Steele. I was about to show him the grave.
Of the woman neither of us met, but I suppose you did, Captain.
Rayford shook his head. Knew who she was, is all. Hey, we're brothers, Doctor. Call me Ray.
Thanks. Call me anything you want except Floyd.
How's Hattie?
Not well. Sleeping.
She's gonna make it?
Dr. Charles shook his head.
I'm not optimistic. The backup at CDC in Atlanta is ridiculous. She and I both have a hunch that what's in her system was put there by the GC. If they ever get to the sample I sent, they'll disavow it or steer me wrong.
They walked back to the primitive grave and stood in silence.
Wish we could put up some kind of marker, Rayford said. But it would be only for us anyway, and we know who she was and where she is. We don't need to draw attention to this place.
Rayford felt deep gratitude that the Tribulation Force was headquartered in what was once this woman's home. He couldn't help cataloging in his mind the deaths in his own circle. The list grew long and ultimately led to Amanda. He had grieved so much already, and he feared he would suffer many more losses before his own number came up. Floyd Charles gave Rayford a quick tour of the place while they brought each other up to date on their respective situations. Rayford was impressed with the house, especially the underground shelter Donnie had fashioned before his own demise. The day would surely come when they would all have to live under rather than in the house. How soon, he couldn't guess. Nothing was predictable anymore, save for the judgments from heaven meticulously outlined on Zion's scriptural charts. Who would survive and for how long was all in God's control and timing? Rayford had heard death rattle breathing before, but the emaciated frame of his former co-worker, friend, and object of flirtation strangely moved him. Rayford stood over Hattie, pitying her, hoping for her, praying for her. He wanted to know what she knew about Amanda, of course, but he wasn't so selfish as to wish she would stay alive only long enough to communicate that. He gently pushed her bangs off her forehead. In the dim light, he couldn't tell whether a mark was there. Dr. Charles shook his head.
She's been talking a lot lately, but she hasn't come to any decision yet. At least she hasn't decided the way we'd like.
Chloe thought she was close, Rayford said.
Lord knows she has enough information. I don't know what it'll take.
I plead with her all the time, the doctor said. She's stubborn. Waiting for something, I don't know. I'm at a loss.
Pray she survives another day, Rayford said.
And wake me if she comes to.
You want something to help you sleep?
Rayford raised his eyebrows.
I didn't figure you for a pill pusher.
I'm careful. Don't use 'em myself, but I'm sympathetic to globetrotters like you.
I've never had trouble sleeping.
Good for you.
Rayford turned to head upstairs and stopped.
How about you, Doc? Having trouble sleeping?
I told you I don't use sleeping pills.
That's not what I asked.
Dr. Charles looked down and shook his head.
How'd you guess?
You look wasted, sorry to say.
Floyd nodded without expression.
You want to talk? Rayford said.
You're tired.
Hey, Doc, the way I understand it, when you leave the hospital, you're gonna join us.
We're like family. I make time for family.
It's just that I didn't expect to tell anybody about this until everyone got back.
Rayford pulled out a kitchen chair.
About what?
I'm in your boat, Rayford. Free of the GC, you mean? You've been fired? I've got a believer friend at the hospital. I was on the phone to him in the middle of the night, apparently when Ken was trying to reach me. He told me he didn't know where I was and didn't want to know, but he said, friend to friend, disappear. Rayford reached to shake his hand. Welcome to the club. You think anybody followed you here? No, I made sure of that. But I've been gone from the hospital so much and was apparently suspicious enough. If they don't know where you are, you're safe and so are we. Dr. Charles leaned back against the refrigerator. Thing is, I don't want to be a burden. The GC paid well, and I never compromised my principles. I worked hard to save lives and get people well. In other words, you're allowed to have less of a conscience problem than I about making a living working for the enemy? I wasn't implying anything. I know. You're worried about joining us without being able to carry your weight. Exactly. Look at me, Doc. I'm one of the charter members, and here I am without income. I wish that made me feel better. I think we can provide room and board in exchange for medical services. That puts you way ahead of me. I'm just an extra pilot now, and I've got no plane. Rayford saw the hint of a smile, but then Floyd's knees buckled. You all right? Just tired. When did you sleep last? It's been a while, but don't worry about it. How long since you've slept? Too long, but I'm all right. Ken, Rayford called. Ritz came up from the basement. You feel up to sitting with Hattie a while? I'm good. I got so much caffeine in me, I'll be up all day anyway. The doctor looked deeply thankful. I'm going to take you gentlemen up on this. Thank you. He gave Ken a few instructions, then trudged upstairs. Ken sat next to Hattie's bed with his Bible on one knee and a laptop on the other. Rayford was amused at Ken's peeking over the top of his half-glasses to be sure Hattie was all right. He was one long-legged babysitter. A few minutes later, as Rayford stretched out on the bed upstairs, he could hear Floyd snoring already in the next room. 24 hours before the opening evening session of the meeting of the witnesses, Buck, Chloe, and Zion joined the local committee at the stadium for a final walkthrough of the program. They returned to the van to find a message from Chaim via Yaakov. The driver read from a scrap of paper. Dr. Rosenzweig was summoned to the quarters of the potentate and has come back with a personal request from the Supreme Commander. I can't wait, Buck said. I beg your pardon, sir. Just an expression. Can you tell us what the request... Oh, no, sir. I was merely asked to get you back to Dr. Rosenzweig as quickly as possible. Buck leaned closer to Zion. What do you make of it? What would Fortunato want? I should expect Carpathia would like to meet me, probably for public relations or political reasons. Why wouldn't Carpathia have talked to Rosenzweig himself? Protocol. You know that, Cameron. But they're old friends, Chloe said. They go way back. Didn't Rosenzweig introduce you to Carpathia in the first place, Buck? Buck nodded. No doubt Nikolai enjoys keeping him in his place. They arrived back at Chaim's complex to find him bubbling with enthusiasm. I am not a fool, Zion, the old man said. I am aware that you have pitted yourself against my friend and argued with him publicly via the internet, but I am telling you, you have him wrong. He is a wonderful man, a godly man, if I may say. The fact that he is humbly asking for a place on the program shows his goodwill and... A place on the program, Chloe said. Impossible. The stadium will be full of Jewish converts who are convinced Nikolai is Antichrist himself. Oh, sweetheart, Chaim said, smiling at her. Nikolai Carpathia? He seeks world peace, disarmament, global unity.
My point exactly.
Chaim turned to his protege. Zion, surely you can see that the only expedient thing to do is cordially welcome him to the stage.
You spoke with Carpathia yourself, Chaim?
The older man cocked his head and shrugged.
Of course not. He is a very busy man. Supreme Commander Fortunato is his most trusted.
Too busy for you, Zion said.
You are a national hero, an icon, the man who helped make Israel what she is today. Your formula was the key to Carpathia's power. How can he forget that and refuse to see an old friend like...
He did not refuse me, Zion. If I had merely asked, he would have granted me an audience.
Regardless, Zion said, Chloe is right. Much as I would love to humiliate him, it would be just too awkward. What kind of reception do you think he will get from the 25,000 witnesses we will cram into the stadium and nearly 100,000 more at other sites around the city?
Surely out of Christian charity they would be cordial to the world ruler.
Zion shook his head and leaned forward, resting his hand on his former mentor's knee.
Dr. Rosenzweig, you have been like a father to me. I love you. I would welcome you to the stadium with open arms, but Nikolai,
I am not a believer, Zion, so why not welcome another with the same openness?
Because he is more than simply not a believer. He is the enemy of God, of everything we stand for. Though you are not yet a believer, we do not consider you an enemy.
Not yet a believer?
Chaim rocked back and laughed.
You say that with such confidence.
I pray for you every day.
And I appreciate that more than I can say, my friend. But I am Jewish born and bred. Though I am not religious, I do believe Messiah is yet to come. Do not hold out hope that I shall become one of your witnesses.
Chaim. Did you not hear my evidence the night I shared it with the world?
Yes, it was fascinating. And no one can argue it was not persuasive. Look at what has come of it. But surely you do not claim it is for everyone.
Buck could feel Zion's incredulity.
Dr. Rosenzweig, the rabbi said, I would be so grateful if you would allow me to plead my case to you. If I could personally show you my texts, my arguments, I believe I could prove to you that Jesus Christ is the Messiah and that Nikolai Carpathia is his arch enemy. I would love to just...
I will give you that privilege one day, my friend, Rosenzweig said.
But not the night before one of the biggest days of your life.
And I must tell you, I would sooner believe Jesus was the Messiah than that Nikolai is his enemy. That is simply not the man I know.
I have the energy and the enthusiasm tonight, Doctor. Please.
Well, Chaim said, smiling, I do not. I will make a deal with you, however. You grant Nikolai a place on the program during your opening night, and I will give you my full attention on these matters at a later date.
Rosenzweig sat back, appearing pleased with his suggestion. Zion, clearly frustrated, looked at Bach, then at Chloe. He shrugged.
I do not know, he said. I just do not know.
Frankly, Doctor, I could wish that a dear old friend like you would listen to the heart of an admirer without condition.
Rosenzweig stood and stepped to the window, where he peered through a sliver between the curtains.
Nikolai has provided the armed guards that ensure you will not suffer the way your family did, and that you will not again be chased from your homeland. All I ask is that you treat the most powerful man in the world with the deference he deserves. If you choose not to, I will be disappointed, but I will not make this a condition of eventually letting you try to persuade me of your position.
Zion stood and thrust his hands deep into his pockets.
He turned his back to Buck and the others. "Well, thank you for that," he said, barely above a whisper. "I shall have to pray about what to do about Carpathia's request." Buck couldn't imagine how Carpathia could show his face at such a meeting, or what response he might get from the assembled. Why would Carpathia subject himself to it? "Zion," Chaim said, "I must get back to the potentate with a response tonight. I said I would." "Chaim, I will not have an answer until I have prayed about it. If Mr. Fortunato insists..." "It is not his insistence, Zion. I gave my word. I do not have an answer. All I can tell him is that you are praying about it?" "Exactly. Zion, who do you think secured Kollek Stadium for you?" "I do not know." "Nikolai, do you think my countrymen would have offered it? You have aligned yourself with the two at the Wailing Wall who have cursed our country, your country. They have boasted of causing the drought that has crippled us. They turn water into blood, bring plagues upon us. It is rumored they will appear at the stadium themselves." "I can only hope," Zion said. The men turned to face each other, both with hands spread. "My dear Zion," Chaim said, "you see what we have come to? If Nikolai is bold enough to address a stadium full of his enemies, he must be admired." "I will pray," Zion said. "That is all I can say." As they went off to bed, Buck heard Chaim on the phone with Fortunato. "Leon, I am sorry." Late in the afternoon in Illinois, Rayford was awakened by footsteps on the stairs. The door opened. "You awake, Ray?" Rayford sat up, staring,